The temple will crumble and it will fall. False prophets, they will betray you. War is inevitable. The earth will shake and people will suffer and they will die. These are the signs that were predicted to you by Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Joel, and they are signs that you will see very soon. Keep awake. Be ready. Do not disappoint your God. Jesus, as he is preparing for his own death, predicts the death of everyone else too. Why? Is it because as the anointed one, he has some insider knowledge? Maybe. But Jesus, at least as we know him in the Gospel of Mark, is by his very nature an apocalyptic leader. And because it has all happened before. Apocalypse comes from the Greek word apokalyptein, which means to uncover or to reveal. So in apocalyptic storytelling, or in apocalypse as a mind view, as a mindset, a worldview, there is an understanding that there is a truth that is yet to be revealed, a truth about our world and our life that can only be revealed by some kind of otherworldly being. Can't be a human. Has to be something different. There's also an understanding that we need that revelation that human history is completely unredeemable without outside intervention. And that intervention is coming soon. That intervention is on its way. And you'll know it is here when there is judgment and death of the wicked, followed by resurrection and afterlife. Now, you might remember that resurrection is not unique to Christianity. We didn't make that up. You hear in earlier passages in this very gospel that the sages and the elders debate with Jesus about the resurrection of Elijah. And we know from the historical record that there was a Roman religious leader named Apollonius who is described in much the same terms as Jesus and described as having a resurrection almost identical to Jesus's and within the same historical era. So Jesus is speaking and preaching in a way that is familiar. His speech is like it would be for anyone who participated in this apocalyptic worldview. He's not giving some kind of brand new prediction right here in the Gospel of Mark. Instead, he is confirming, he is affirming existing theology about the relationship between God and humanity. The Jesus movement was one of the strongest and most committed to the apocalyptic view of this necessary encounter between this world and the other world. But Jesus, in this passage, is also reminding his people of their own recent history. So about 200 years before Jesus was born, the people of Judea were under rule by Antiochus the Fourth. He was a Syrian king. So they were occupied by a Syrian king named Antiochus the Fourth, about 200 years before Jesus. And during Antiochus's rule, there arose a rivalry within one of the priestly families. If you remember, not everyone could become a priest, but only people in particular families. And there was a rivalry in one. And a priest named Jason approached Antiochus and said, "I'll give you a lot of money, I'll bribe you, if you will make me the high priest instead of my brother." Antiochus said, "Great, I'll take your cash money, you are now the high priest." So Jason then began a campaign to remake Jerusalem's structure so that it was more like a Greek city-state. Now, Antiochus was on board with the Hellenization of all of his holdings. It worked really well, he found, to suppress local culture and religion and practices and bring a more universal political structure like the Greeks, and the Greeks who were the best. It pacified them. It made them less rowdy. And Antiochus really wanted Judea to be pacified because it was right next door to Egypt, and he really wanted to conquer Egypt. So Jason's program of Hellenization included determining who is a citizen and who is not, who has aristocratic rights and who does not, and establishing a Greek-style gymnasium in the center of Jerusalem for the training of young men in leadership. Now, Jason didn't do this without support. For the elite of Jerusalem, this Hellenization program was also great, because by adopting the Greek style of doing business and politics, they gained recognition and a common language with their neighbors. It made social and political and economic sense as much for the elites of Jerusalem as it did for Antiochus. So they were all in because they could make more money and become an international player by this process. But then came Menelaus. Menelaus wanted to be the high priest himself, but he didn't come from a priestly family. He had no reason to have access to the priesthood. But he learned, all you have to do is bribe this guy. You just got to bribe the king. So Menelaus approaches Antiochus IV and says, I'll give you even more money than Jason did. Super. Now you're the high priest. The thing is that Menelaus didn't have the money. But as high priest, what does he now have access to? The money in the temple. So Menelaus paid off his bribe by stealing money from the temple and giving it to Antiochus. And Antiochus then was like, wow, I can take money from the temple too. And so he did. Jason and his followers were understandably upset. Not only had he been displaced by someone who wasn't a real priest, but this had been a desecration of the temple. It's one thing to change the political structure, but another to go after the temple. And so Jason went to war against Menelaus, which Antiochus took personally, and he slaughtered Jason. And he slaughtered Jason's followers. And then, having killed everyone, Antiochus and Menelaus go back into the temple to take even more money, to further desecrate the sacred home of God in the world. And then they went even further. They didn't just continue Jason's program of Hellenizing the politics. They kicked Judaism out of the temple. They kicked Judaism out of the house of God and in its place put this kind of nice, universal, syncretic, blended religion that now everyone was required to practice. And in fact, any sign that you were being exclusively Jewish, like if you were circumcised or you owned a copy of Torah, could lead to your execution. So Jerusalem was no longer a theocracy. Torah was no longer the law of the land. Absolutely every part of this nation, social, political, cultural, and religious, had been upended because of Antiochus, Jason, and Menelaus. And the people fought back, literally. The revolt that occurred next led to the miracle of lights that is now celebrated every Hanukkah. This period in ancient Jewish history was known as the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. So then, a short 200 years later, there's Jesus and his followers. Now, they're no longer occupied by the Syrians, but by the Romans. So the Syrian occupiers have been replaced by Roman occupiers. But what are the elite doing? They're still in cahoots with their occupiers for their own financial gain. And the leaders of the temple, at least in Jesus' eyes, are as corrupt as they were under the reign of Menelaus. So what will happen? What will happen to Jesus and his followers as they try to retain their Jewish identity in the face of this all-too-familiar threat? And what will those who are offering the threats do in response to Jesus' very public and very active resistance? He's reminding them of the answer in today's passage. Remember what happened under Menelaus? Whole-scale violence and destruction. It's coming again, folks. Here it is again. Jesus isn't just trying to scare his disciples. He's not using fear as a coercive tactic. He's not trying to scare people into following them. He's just reminding them of what they already know, that when the marginalized and the powerless in an occupied nation try to retain their identity and rights, they will suffer. But Jesus is also offering them some hope. He is suggesting that the coming battle, the coming revelation, the apocalypse, will be the last one. This one will be the final one. And finally, after our years of journey in the wilderness, we, the children of God, will live again with God in a new Eden. The signs are coming. Be ready for it. For finally, this will be done, and we will be God's people again. So next week, Pastor Hannah mentioned, is Palm Sunday, which is a great day because we get all the palms and we have the kids run around with palms. It's a great celebration of Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem. And that's how we'll begin our service. But toward the end of the service, we will shift our tone a little bit and we'll begin to prepare ourselves to walk with Jesus beyond Jerusalem and into Golgotha, where the cross awaits. The cross stands for all of the things that we still need to be saved from: our casual brutality, our willingness to deny people their rights, the pain of hating and of being hated. As fantastic as our imagery and language and theology about God can be, what we need saving from is very earthy and very earthly. Jesus offered his people hope by saying, "For once and for all, the sacred and profane will be united as one, and all pain and horror will finally cease." He offered them that hope, and we are the bearers. We are the continuing stewards of that hope. Not because of some provincial apocalyptic prediction by Jesus, but because of the universal creative presence of the Christ. It isn't a one-time historic collision that gives us hope, but the life-affirming message of Easter morning. So as we prepare over these next 2 weeks to confront our own collusion with power and our own desire to be on that better way of Jesus, stay alert. Be vigilant in your resistance to power and your devotion to God. For all has already been revealed, but with our help, all will be relieved. Amen.